This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is a very busy time to be the mayor of Boston, but he is taking time out for us anyway in our monthly Mondays with Mayor Marty Walsh. So welcoming back to the show, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Hello.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you today.
Great to have you. I kind of want to paint this picture, Mayor Walsh, because I was thinking about your last 10 days or so. A ballot box set on fire, daily statewide coronavirus cases above 1,000 people, in-person learning shut down in the schools. The chair of the Boston School Committee resigns even as they make an historic move to suspend the entrance exam to the exam schools. State lifts the eviction moratorium, three major holidays ahead. It is a massive task to be the mayor of Boston right now. How are you doing?
And don't forget about, we have a little election a week from Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, that.
You know, Boston's a great city, and I love being the mayor of our city. Obviously, every day there's new challenges that are in front of us. These are just very extraordinary times that we're all living in, and it's important for all of us to understand that, you know, we will get through all of these things. You know, it's complicated. I was saying the other day that to my chief of staff that, you know, there just doesn't seem to be any reprieve at all. You know, the other night, school committee meeting, there was a historic vote, lots of conversation, lots of emotion around it. And then to end the way it did was unfortunate. But you know, hopefully after next Tuesday, you know, coronavirus on top of it all has been very tense for everyone. So after next Tuesday, we'll see what happens. But I'm hoping for a certain outcome in that election. I think a lot of people who are listening to this radio show are hoping for the same outcome I'm hoping for. And you know, in this country, there's a lot of turmoil, and right now we have to get through it. And you didn't mention, but the racial unrest as well, the systemic racism, all of that stuff is front and center. And it's important for us to continue to move forward one foot in front of the other to get through this time.
So you just talked about the election. Let's just stay there for a minute. Police have made an arrest in the case of the ballots that were set on fire in a drop box in Copley Square yesterday. Are you concerned about more cases of election-related violence or tampering or vandalism? And how are you preparing the city for that?
Well, you know, I'm hoping that we don't have any violence. I think a lot of it's going to be what happened in the election. I think that, you know, you have one candidate in the president that has undertones of you know, creating, okaying violence. It's not going to be tolerated here in the city of Boston. The police department has increased their patrols in areas where election ballot boxes are located, but also we're preparing for election day to make sure that we have, and I don't think it's going to happen here, voter intimidation. I don't think we'll see it here in Boston. But you never know around the country. I think you'll see different pieces of it. As far as the ballot box, I want to thank the Boston Police Department for their swift action, and our law enforcement partners and members of the community played a role to arrest the suspect in Copley Square for the ballot box incident. This was an isolated incident, and so we're going to be making sure that we've asked the district attorney to investigate it to its fullest extent. Our number one priority is certainly making sure that the integrity of the elections are upheld. And I want to thank all the partners, and I think as we continue to move forward here, I think that hopefully this is an isolated incident. I think it might be, but we are going to continue. We have the book boxes monitored under surveillance cameras, and we're going to be increasing our security so people feel free to vote. And we want everyone to vote. So, you know, if you have an early vote ballot and you want to use these boxes in the primary, we had a couple places. We have 17 right now in the final. So we want you to use these boxes. We want you to make sure that, you know, you do your early vote, get all that in if you can, because the more people that vote now, the less lines we'll have on election day.
We talked a minute ago about some of these challenges with the coronavirus. The city now has an average positive test rate above 6%, according to the city's latest analysis of neighborhood testing data. I wanted to ask you, so we've been hearing public health officials for a while anticipate some kind of surge in the fall. And I wondered, are the numbers that we're actually seeing now in line with what you expected for this time of year and whatever modeling or planning you might have done? Or are these surges, is this surge bigger than you thought we'd be in right now? How are you looking at it and thinking about it?
I don't think that categorizes as a surge yet. It's definitely an increase. We're seeing our numbers go up every week now. The new numbers as of today, from yesterday and over the weekend, 273 new cases, which is a lot, probably the highest I've seen in a one day Actually, it might be 2 days in this number, but we're seeing we're in the 100-something range every day now for the last couple of days. That's the highest we've seen since around June. So certainly, our priority is making sure residents are safe and healthy. The experts have said that we would see potentially an uptick in the month of October, November, and December. And they also had mentioned that it is incumbent upon all of us that we could actually keep those numbers down by wearing masks and making sure that we do everything we can, social distancing, avoiding large gatherings. I'm also encouraging people two things today, to get tested. I think it's really important to have an accurate number of tests here in the city of Boston so we get an accurate account of what the number really is. And right now it's 6.2%. And the second piece is suggesting to people to get your flu shot, because as we head into this month of September, October, November area, that a lot of people are going to get the cold flu, and we it'll be confusing, and we want to try and cut down on emergency room visits if at all possible.
Mayor Walsh, callers are ready, so let's go to the phones. 800-423-8255. We've got Alicia on the line from Roslindale. Alicia, you're on with Mayor Marty Walsh.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm curious about Boston Public Schools. I know last week you announced that schools would remain closed until the infection rate dropped below 5%, yet I haven't seen the city or your administration make any announcements about reverting to a previous phase in order to lower the case rate and get our kids back to school. So I'd love to speak to that.
You dropped out there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're talking about schools. You haven't seen something. Sorry.
Well, I'm curious to know, and you said that schools would not reopen until the case rate dropped below 5%, yet I haven't seen the administration or the city take any steps to revert to a previous phase in order to lower the case rate so that kids can go back to school. So I'm wondering if you could address that.
I mean, no, what's happening now is we had the phases, the six phases and approaches. The first was on all online, second was highest needs, third was going to be kindergarten, 0, 1, and 2. What we were able to do was keep our high-need students in school through an increase of 4%. When it got to 5.7, we made the decision to close it. The next increase was from 5.7 to 6.2. So if we have two back-to-back weeks of 5% or less, we can bring our in-person high-need students back. And if we get to 4% or less, we will start the phased-in approach. And what we're trying to do now is really just explain to people the importance of staying consistent and not spreading this, stopping the spread of the virus. And I think that's something that's really important that we continue to do. We will not be able to reopen schools until we get to that point. As a matter of fact, there's not one single factor that's led to the increase of COVID. However, the bottom line is when more people see each other, that's where the COVID spread happens. And we're serious about reminding residents about COVID-19 guidelines that are in place. I can't stress enough wearing masks, washing hands, avoiding large gatherings, because, at the moment, we're concerned about, our restaurants and our hair salons and our parks and everything else. At some point, if we continue to grow here, we'll have to take further action.
So, Mayor Walsh, I want to stop you there for a second, because I do think part of what Alicia was asking was, if we need to get back below 5% for the schools, are you not taking steps to roll back the phased reopening to a place where maybe hair salons are closed, or, back to phase one or an earlier part of phase two? I think that was part of her question.
Right now, the numbers don't reflect that the increase is because of restaurants and things like that, and we are watching them. If you notice, the governor took some action on, I think it was Friday, he saw outbreaks and through the tracing in youth hockey. They saw increases in youth hockey in, I think, 30 programs across the Commonwealth. So they rolled back that one area. So we are looking right now, our public health department is looking at all of what we've opened to see what and if and when we have to roll things back.
So I do want to stay on that then for a minute, Mayor Walsh, because the same day that you announced that in-person schooling would have to cease, DESE put out a statement saying that districts and schools currently open for in-person instruction, quote, are encouraged to remain open even if their local community is designated as red, so long as there is no evidence of COVID-19 transmission in schools, end quote. Were you seeing evidence of transmission in the schools? And if not,
no.
I know how important it was for you to have high-need learners in the schools. Why take that step?
The way that the state does their red category and the way we do ours, we're using almost two different metrics. The state's category is any 8 cases per 100,000 people. In some of the cities and towns across Massachusetts are smaller towns, and 8 cases puts them in the red instantaneously. And I think if you can isolate and track those cases back to where they came from, you don't have to close school. I think the DESE guidelines and the CDC guidelines call for a 5% test rate. All schools should be shut down. You can't compare Boston to every city and town. It's like comparing apples to oranges. It just doesn't work that way. And quite honestly, when we looked at the rate, we made it very clear. We actually went with a more conservative number of 4%. And it really is about making sure that our students, our teachers, our staff, our faculty, our parents are all safe. And that's why we chose the 4% rate to close school if we had to. We were able to, with the high-need students, our public health department looked at that number and realized that, we're talking, we had an average of 10 people in the school. So we felt at a above 4% rate, we could teach safely and our kids would be in a safe environment. The issue was that we went from 4.4% to 5.7% in a one-week period. And that number was just too big of a number to risk keeping school open for another week. And if we had kept it open, it would have been shut down, obviously, on Friday because we went to 6.2%.
So as you think about what it's going to take now that we are beginning to surge and we're headed into cold weather and flu season, do you have any optimism that you'll be able to get the high need learners back in school fairly quickly, or there were other phases you had already postponed of putting other kids back in the classroom, in the building? Are we potentially looking at spring now before young people are back in school buildings?
Before we even get there, I think we have to get our number back down. We are still below the average COVID that we saw at the peak in April and May. We are not at the point where we need to shut everything down again. We're experiencing what living with COVID looks like, but being able to move forward and recover while containing outbreaks of the virus is really important for us. So we are concerned that increased activity that's happening, we're doing targeted responses in neighborhoods and demographics, which the cases might be the highest. So we're bringing mobile testing to multilingual communities, outreach to those neighborhoods. And half of our cases are right now coming roughly half are coming out of Latino community. We're bringing bilingual outreach and extra free testing for those communities, so we can try and get that under control. We also have many families, multi-generational families living in households, and if they need support, we need to help them with that. The other half of our cases are coming with people under the age of 30 years old. So it's not even college students. It's students that kind of came out of college that are now in the workforce. And I've been urging young people, young adults, to avoid gatherings. We had not many this weekend, but previous weeks we've got many reports of house parties, and we're working on developing enforcement strategies. So if we don't get the average case under control, then obviously it's not only going to be detrimental potentially to school and when we can bring kids back, it's going to be detrimental to all the other businesses and areas in the city of Boston.
I want to shift gears here because the state eviction moratorium expired on the 17th, a week ago Saturday. Courts are going to start moving through a backlog of eviction cases. A recent WBUR analysis found nearly 750 of those cases were filed in Boston from January to September. What are you doing to help people facing eviction, and what are the important next steps?
Well, I think that first and foremost, we kept our eviction moratorium in the city of Boston in place. These are Boston Public Housing Authority sites. The families in there are also concerned about eviction, so we kept the eviction moratorium through the end of the year. Continue to advocate with both the state and federal government for more resources, more relief, and more protections. As you just said, right now we're facing a crisis as a city, and we must take whatever steps we can to intervene to help and provide assistance. was sending mailers with messages in 9 different languages to 46,000 households in Boston that may be in risk of eviction. It lets them know clearly what they can do, what they can do not to have, they don't have to leave their homes if they receive notice to quit. It points them to information resources. We're also encouraging people. I invited owners of buildings and managers of buildings of low-income apartments to sign the Housing Stability Pledge. This is what they say in the pledge. They're going to abide by the CDC moratorium on evictions for renters who have lost their income due to COVID-19. They're going to be engaging with tenants to create workable payment plans if they're behind on their rent. They're going to accept rental assistance that the city or other agencies provide. So we have a program, and the state's putting together a program. We're asking them to be flexible in specific ways when tenants have lost their income. We also announced the reopening of applications for our rental assistance fund. The fund
and
is created
and,
April
and you're fair. Putting, I think, $5 million more dollars into that rental assistance
five,
fund. Is that right?
$5 million into that. And then also we're suggesting that not only renters but homeowners also reach out, because a lot of times they have tenants that might not understand where they can go for resources. And the Office of Housing Stability in the City of Boston, our website, they can go to the Office of Housing Stability and find out how they access these programs.
And Mayor Walsh, the Housing Stability Pledge, what happens if someone who signed it breaks the pledge? Are there teeth there? Do you have enforcement?
I don't want to look at the negative of that. I mean, I don't see why a landowner or a landlord or a manager would sign the pledge and break the pledge. I just don't see why they would even take the time out. But we're constantly staying and we're preparing for, I'm not sure what the numbers are going to be here in the city. Some studies have said in Massachusetts the numbers are going to be high. I'm not sure if that will be the same case in Boston, but we're working every day. Our housing office is working every day to keep renters and homeowners, quite honestly, to be able to not lose their homes. So we've worked with banks and worked out deals with banks where people are worrying about being foreclosed on. So we're working on all these different levels.
So let's don't move on to police, because we didn't mention that one at the top either when I was giving the laundry list of your last 10 days or so, but you embraced the full slate of reforms recommended by the Reform Task Force last month. And I know the first part of that package went before the City Council last week. That has to do with the proposal to give more preference to Boston Public School grads who want to work for the department. That also requires a change in state law. Are you feeling good about that happening, the necessary changes being made?
We'll see. I mean, we're going to file that with the council. The council will pass it, and then we'll put up to the State House as a home rule petition. I'm hoping that they'll accept that. Much of the reform that was filed that the task force did, most of that work can be done without law changes and without negotiations. So we're working towards in putting all of these different pieces in place. The action that was taken 2 weeks ago now, the timeline is about 180 days. We're going to have to create an Office of Police Accountability and Transparency that's going to have full subpoena power. We're also working on, within the police department, creating a diversity and inclusion unit within the police department to work on representation and equity for officers of color. The Body Worn Camera program, we have it here in Boston, and we're looking to expand it. And also looking at the call for enhanced use of force policies that's articulated in the CLID disciplinary code. That's going to be done by the police department. So we're working, and we're also going to, all of this information is going to be up on a dashboard. It's the cost of greater transparency. So we're going to be putting all this stuff on a dashboard. We're working on all these things now.
We've got about 2 minutes left. Mayor Walsh, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association has been critical of the recommendations. We talked to the head of the association, Larry Calderoni, the day after the recommendations released. I asked him if he had attempted to reach out to the task force during their process or vice versa, and he said no. But he has been quite critical of their exclusion from the process. So how do you think about the path forward with the union on the portions where their cooperation or their contract is really important?
I think the majority of the officers understand the importance of this task force. I mean, I think we're one of the first cities in America that took this very seriously and came up with recommendations in a very timely fashion. I'm trying to look at other places in America where they've done this task force, and I haven't seen other cities that have worked so quickly. This is an important moment in time for all of us. Racism is real in America. Systemic racism has been in America forever, and now's the time for us to take action and move forward. And The police task force is one component of this, and it really doesn't hurt police officers. If anything, it continues to build confidence, and that's what we have to do here. And it allows the public an opportunity, if they want to put complaints in or concerns they have, that they don't have to go to the police department. They don't even come to City Hall. This office will not be housed in City Hall. It will be a city office, but we want to make it easy for people to come in and feel that they can come in, and if they want to make a complaint, they can, and then they can track that complaint in real time on what's going to be a dashboard. They're going to be given a number, and to make sure that there's also going to be a civilian component of this, that people will actually get a chance to look at all these cases.
There are a lot of reforms there. You've set a 180-day timeline. What is the most important thing in your mind to get done first?
I don't think there's any per se one important thing, but if I had to pick one important thing, it really is the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency. That's the office that really has been a consistent ask for a long time here. We did have the co-op board, but clearly the co-op board didn't. Their function was 20% of internal affair cases, and it really didn't get to the heart of what people are concerned about. But the other pieces of this, it's all one big piece. So it's important. You can't just do one and not do another. So, but I think the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency is the biggest change that we're going to have here in Boston.
All right. As we close, I wanted to ask you, I voted early at my local polling station on Saturday. Have you voted yet? And what is your method of choice this year?
It's so funny. I've changed my mind so many times. So in the primary, I voted by mail, and it was great. I mailed my ballot in. And it was in there, and you can track it, and it worked out really well. On election day, I intend on going to the polls on election day this time. I might do an early vote, I might do a mail-in ballot still, but I've gone back and forth. I'm kind of a traditionalist. I like to go in and vote on election day, but I am encouraging people, whatever your means of voting is, you still have plenty of time to get your mail-in ballot. If you've mailed it in and you're not sure your ballot is, you can track your ballot online. And I'm just asking everyone, make sure you go out and vote on Tuesday. You know, you can vote at City Hall. You can vote in different locations. You can vote by mail. But make sure everyone gets a chance to vote. Your voice is important. This election is about the future of our country. There's no question about it. This is the most important election in the history of the United States of America. Where we've been for the last 3.5 years and where we need to go are two very different places.
And that is Boston Mayor Marty Walsh in our Mondays with the Mayor. Thank you so much for taking the time out for us today.
That was a fast half hour. Thank you.
It was. Thanks for being here.
Oh my God.
Today we bring you the two candidates running for Congress in the 4th District, Julie Hall and Jake Auchincloss. Now, Joe Kennedy currently holds the seat but chose not to seek re-election while pursuing an unsuccessful bid for the U.S. Senate. The district includes a wide range of communities from Brookline, Newton, Wellesley, up in Greater Boston to the southern part of the state, encompassing Attleboro, Taunton, parts of Fall River, to name a few. So for the rest of today's show, we're going to host a friendly, if competitive, conversation between the two candidates. Let's introduce them to you now. Jake Auchincloss is the Democrat in the race. He was a captain in the United States Marine Corps, serving from 2010 to 2014. Since 2015, he served on Newton's City Council, where he's chair of the Public Safety and Transportation Committee, and he's also worked at a cybersecurity startup and with Liberty Mutual. Jake Auchincloss, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, Julie Hall is the Republican in the race. Hall served in the Air Force for 30 years, retiring as a colonel in 2009. While in the Air Force, she served in leadership roles for health clinics and as an executive for a healthcare system. After retiring from the Air Force, she served as a state counselor in Attleboro. And in 2014, she was named Massachusetts Outstanding Woman Veteran of the Year. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, briefly, here's how this is going to work. I'm not going to use a formal clock, but I am asking each side to keep responses to any particular question to a minute. I will pose questions to individual candidates as well as some questions to both of you. And if I address a question specifically to one candidate, the other candidate may request 30 seconds to respond after the candidate to whom the question was addressed has given their answer. Now, we flipped a coin before the show. Jake will give the first answer to the first question. Julie will deliver the first closing statement at the end of the discussion. So let's get started. I'm going to give an opening question. It is the same for both of you. Jake will answer it first. And the question is, what is the single most important issue facing the 4th District in Massachusetts? And why are you the best person suited to address it? Jake, you first.
The single most important issue is COVID response and recovery. After 4 years of this Trump administration, this country is weaker, sicker, and poorer than when we started. And perhaps most devastatingly, we're more divided than we have been at any time since the Civil War. As a Marine officer, I commanded Americans from all walks of life overseas. As a city councilor, I've worked together with friends and neighbors and fellow elected officials to make progress on transportation and housing. And as a member of Congress, I'm going to be someone who brings people together to get things done. And to get to the other side of this pandemic, we need to bring together people to put science in the driver's seat and to make real progress on testing, contact tracing, vaccine development and distribution, and generally allowing expertise to make decisions as opposed to the showboating that we've seen from the Trump administration. I'm going to be a member of Congress who listens to science.
Okay, Julie Hall, same question to you, and let me know if you need me to repeat it.
No, I think I'm pretty good with this. Well, you know, one of the things that we do is we are focusing on the virus. And I recently read an article that, you know, public health is much more than the virus. We need to be looking at people getting back to work. We need to be looking at mental health of people. So I totally agree. We need to get people back to work as soon as we possibly can. We need to get the kids back to school. You know, we need to get into some kind of normalcy. So when we, you know, if we think about doing things at a federal level, one of the biggest things I would be looking for right now, and I'm seeing this as I go around and talk to my constituents out there, there's a lot of mental health issues that are already starting to crop up. So that would be one of the things that I think we need to start looking at right away. You know, people had to see their parents and other loved ones pass away without being able to grieve. And I think that's going to cause us a lot of concerns. We have children, you know, that have autistic children that need structure.
So I'm going to ask you to wrap it up there if you could.
And they don't have that structure. They're not able to go back to school. I'm hearing from parents every day that these children are having difficulties.
Okay, I'm sorry, so Julie. I don't mean to be rude, but I'm gonna stop you there just because we're trying to keep responses to about
a
minute.
So I'm going to stop you there,
Julie. Julie, are you able to hear me?
No. So we need to get our small businesses shored up. And I've spent a lot of time speaking to the small businesses around the area, in particular, the restaurants.
So Julie, I'm going to, Julie.
Hit so hard. One
Julie,
of the things
can
I
you
do
hear
like
me?
About what's going on right now at the federal government level.
Okay, so this is live radio, folks. You're hearing it happen right now. I don't think Julie can hear me in response. So we're going to take a quick second here, bring her mic down, see if we can check in with her and see if we can make sure that she's able to hear me back. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to ask Jake a question, and I will make sure that Julie gets equal time on an equal question once we have her sound back up. Jake, I want to stay on the coronavirus. The state had more than 1,000 new cases of the virus 2 days in a row over the weekend. We are now seeing, you know, the highest one-day increases since May as of last Thursday. 77 cities and towns are in the high-risk red zone. Now, you have said that economic recovery will come when we have a coordinated coronavirus recovery. Cases are rising. We do not have a statewide coordinated approach. School districts are making their own decisions about reopening. Cities and towns are making different choices about when and how to either progress or roll back in the state's economic reopening plan. How can that economic recovery happen? And if elected, would you push the governor to enact a more coordinated or centralized response this fall and winter?
We cannot have a safe reopening of the economy until we have coronavirus under control. And that seems to be a fundamental disagreement between Democrats and Republicans. The Trump administration's catastrophic mishandling of this virus has cratered our economy. It's shuttered our schools. It's cost almost 250,000 Americans their lives. And what we need to do is have strong federal-state coordination for testing of asymptomatic people using PCR. We need to have a contact tracing program that is well-funded and well-organized. We need to have mask requirements and targeted lockdown strategies where appropriate. And then we've got to have vaccine development and distribution that can scale up rapidly. Until we do that, we're not going to be able to safely reopen this economy, get people back to work, get kids back to school. And unfortunately, this administration has ignored science. What we need to do is put science back in the driver's seat and listen to public health experts on the path forward, because we know the right levers to use here for public health. But what we need is a competent, coordinated political response. I'll be a bridge between Washington and the State House on that.
And at the state level, which is really under the governor's control now, do you think there needs to be more coordination, Jake?
I think there needs to be more coordination between the federal government and state governments, and between government in general and the scientific and business communities as well. What we have seen is a lot of actors at federal, state, and local level, a lot of actors in business doing their part, but it's not always syncing together perfectly. And I'm somebody who, throughout the course of my career, has worked with people to solve problems, and I can do that again as a member of Congress.
Okay, Julie Hall, do we have you back?
You do. Thank you.
I'm sorry we were having technical difficulties there, Julie. So just so you know, while we were reconnecting with you, I was asking Jake a question about the coronavirus. I'm going to ask you one now. I want to talk about how you've talked about the virus and measures for responding to it. You've compared the virus to a super flu, and you've said that you will wear a mask to protect your community and keep businesses open, but you've also raised questions about the efficacy of masks. We know scientific journals such as Nature have been clear that the research shows masks can save lives, reduce transmission. The coronavirus is more deadly than the flu. So I want to check in. What is your official position on mask usage and on the threat of the virus to the people of Massachusetts right now?
Sure. Well, I just have been reading up on this, and I read an article from April 2020 from the New England Medical Journal. And so there's been a lot of discussions when people say, the experts say. And I think that's the difficulty. You know, I'm reading New England Medical Journal, and so there's some there's controversy there. However, I have said I do believe that the mask does help with some of this, but you also have to do the hand washing and all of that other stuff. Now, when you're outside, when I'm outside and I'm not around anybody, yes, I'm not going to wear a mask if I'm not around anybody. If I happen to walk by somebody, I'm going to make sure that I stay away from that person. But I do wear the mask when I go into an enclosed environment, definitely.
And do you feel we are in a different stage now than we were in the spring? And what urgency do you feel around things like hygiene practices, social distancing, people, you know, not gathering over the holidays, et cetera, during this time?
You know, I'm a person who thinks that people need to try to get back and do things back in their life the best they can and staying as safe as they can doing it. We've got a lot of direction and guidance that have come out. But I think that when the difficulty, and I expressed this a little bit earlier, it's causing a lot of other problems. You know, we have people that now are losing their jobs. We have people that are having mental health issues. So, again, I would like to see as much normalcy, if I can say that word, of us being able to get back into the life that we know while being safe at the same time.
Thank you. Now, because you both made this your top issue at the beginning, I'm going to stay on this subject a little bit longer. I've got a question that I'm going to ask both of you. Julie, you'll answer first, and then Jake. Congress has been unable to pass or compromise on a second coronavirus relief package for months. The first package was introduced in March. Now we're in October. You're both running to be in the House. So what would you do to get a deal passed for more stimulus money, and what would be the top priority in terms of who or what gets that money? Julie, if you could give me a minute of response.
Sure. Now, you know, I've worked with different groups before. I worked with the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, and I say this all the time. Those are three separate groups with very, very distinct ideologies. And I was able to come up and help us get a joint command. So what I do is I look for things that we have in common. So as we look for things that we have in common, those are things like we've got to get people back to work. We've got to get people back to work. I want them, and they need to be able to get a stimulus bill going. We have people that are out there that, you know, are going. One of the things we talk about is food insecurity, people not being able to get food. So things are bad. We need to get the money. We need to get another stimulus package down here. But, again, we need to get those businesses going. When people work, they make money. When they make money, they spend money. And all of those go to to taking care of the environment and taking care of the economy. Now, the last thing
I'm going to stop you there. Sorry, Julie, that's a minute. So I'm just going to stop you there. Thanks for the first part of that answer. Jake, same question to you on getting another relief package passed and what the top priority in it would be. 1 minute, please.
Well, my opponent is adopting the Trump tactic of focusing purely on the economy and ignoring the coronavirus, which just doesn't work. We've got to solve the coronavirus before we can safely reopen the economy. And any relief package, I think, has to have three core pillars to it. First, we need flexible relief for state and local budgets. Fiscal years 2021 and 2022 are going to be very tough for cities like Fall River, Taunton, and Attleboro, and they need more flexible relief. And they need to be able to spend the money they already have for programming that they have identified as a priority. Number two, we've got to scale up testing. We've got to have enterprise-level PCR testing for asymptomatic people across all 34 cities and towns in the district, including and especially the public schools. My opponent talks about getting people back to work. Well, a lot of folks can't get back to work until their kids can get back to school. So let's get kids back to school safely by doing ubiquitous testing. And then finally, we need direct relief to working families and small businesses.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to move on now. I want to talk to each of you a little bit about how you talk about yourselves as candidates. Jake, I'll stay with you for a minute. After your primary campaign, you defined yourself as a pragmatic progressive. The eight other Democrats who ran in the primary cast you as the most conservative of that pool of candidates. And you worked for Republican Governor Charlie Baker's campaign in 2014. So what specifically does pragmatic progressive mean? And how does that sync with arguably a pretty progressive agenda among Democrats in the Commonwealth?
Well, I've been a strong supporter of Obama and Clinton and Biden, and I've also been a supporter of Governor Charlie Baker. And I think he's done a good job of handling this pandemic in the last year, and I'll certainly be a strong partner to him in Washington for COVID relief and recovery. I also recognize that the Massachusetts 4th seat is a proud progressive seat held by Joe Kennedy and Barney Frank, and voters can expect me to be a champion for progressive causes that we deeply hold. The Supreme Court is almost certain now to have a 6-3 conservative majority. We have to have a national bill to protect women's access to safe and legal abortions. We need to fight climate change and transition to a clean energy economy. And we must address longstanding inequalities in our communities and combat racial injustice. These are progressive causes that voters are going to see me champion in the House of Representatives.
Okay, thanks for that. Julie, I'll turn to you now. You've called yourself a Julie Hall Republican, rejecting the label of a Trump Republican. You did vote for the president. You have backed up his policies, praised him for his coronavirus response, his approach to the military, his Supreme Court picks. And the Mass GOP has voiced strong support for the president, going so far as to replace the picture of Governor Baker on their homepage with one of Donald Trump. So I want to ask you, are there any specific policy areas where you believe the sitting president has gotten it wrong?
I want to go back to my opponent. You know, I want people to know that, you know, where I stand. I think that people are very comfortable with where I stand and what my policies are all about, unlike my opponent. Now, I want to say he's been a Republican, an independent, and a Democrat in 6 years. He's a flip-flopper. You know, people can change their mind on certain policies, but to change their whole ideological views, to be honest with you, I am hearing time and time again, people just don't trust you, Jake.
I'm going to give Jake a second to respond to that in a minute. But before I do, Julie, I want to come back and ask you again the question, are there any specific policy areas where you believe the sitting president has gotten it wrong?
You know, I think that he should have told people from the beginning. I know people said, he said, I didn't want to tell people because I didn't want to create a panic. And I think that people should have been told.
Thank you for that. And Jake, I'm going to give you a quick moment to respond. And Julie, I'll give you one more chance to respond there too, and then we'll move on. Jake.
Well, I think we've heard from my opponent, one, a strong allegiance to Trump and his dangerous and hateful agenda. And two, the same tactics that he uses, which is ad hominem attacks and fear mongering. I think voters in the Massachusetts 4th and Americans in general are tired of being scared. I think what we're hungry for is decency and unity in our politics. I think we're hungry to make real substantive change together on issues like COVID response, like racial justice, protecting reproductive rights, fighting climate change. passing universal background checks for gun safety. These are issues where we have to work together and not sling mud.
Great. Thank you. And Julie, I'll give you 30 seconds more to respond there. I just want to even this out, and then we're going to go on to the next topic.
Sure. Yeah, you know, and I think that the difficulty is, again, those are all wonderful words to say, but nobody knows where you stand. You've changed your, you know, you've changed your party. I mean, come on, you've changed your party from Republican to Independent to now a Democrat. You've even tried to change where you stand in that party. And frankly, I have a difficult time knowing where you stand. You stand for nothing.
So let's pick up back up on some policy issues then. Jake, I'll give you the first answer to this question. Actually, I'm going to ask you two separate questions. Jake, you've publicly stated that you support demilitarizing the police. You wrote about it in an op-ed for WBUR. Do you support reallocation of other funding from the police to other services, such as mental health response or substance abuse treatment? And are you in favor of changing things like qualified immunity laws? If you give me about a minute for response, please.
Yeah, I'm the chair of public safety in Newton, and in that role, I've strongly supported our independent review of the Newton Police Department to evaluate how functions and funding work. I think it would be totally appropriate to transfer certain functions and appropriate funding to different departments to address mental health or traffic safety or other areas where maybe there are better equipped agencies to do it. I do not support defunding the police. I think we need to just reimagine public safety, and that is a project that each of the 34 cities and towns I hope will take on in the coming years, and I'll certainly be an ally to them as a member of Congress. I also want to just address my opponent's remarks and just make very clear where I stand on some core issues. I
believe please do it very quickly, Jake, about 15 seconds.
Absolutely. I believe that we need to prioritize combating racial injustice in this country. I support Cory Booker's baby bonds bill on that front. I believe that we need to codify women's access to safe and legal abortions at the national level. I believe that we need to fight climate change and transition to a clean energy economy. These are core principles of mine.
Thank you. So, Julie, you have said you're pro-law and order and are behind the police 100%.
Yeah.
You've signed a pledge not to support police reform that would end qualified immunity, defund the police, or create a certification board that didn't have a majority of law enforcement officers. Some version of all of those things are in consideration either in the city of Boston, at the State House, or both. Are there police reforms you do feel are necessary in the Commonwealth, and how would you bring them about? You've got about a minute.
Sure. I believe that there should be some kind of licensing. And I'm going to go back to my background, which is in health administration. We have a licensing process for all our healthcare providers. And in doing that, we're able to deal with what we call impaired providers. And we have a whole process for going through that, identifying them, being able to rehabilitate them. And if they cannot be rehabilitated, then they lose their license. So I see that one particular item as something that can be used with the police force. And I think people that do get licensed, I would hope that most of the police officers out there, would be looking for that. It brings, being licensed professionals is something that brings prestige to an organization also. And I have been endorsed by the Fraternal Order of the Police and the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police. So I do have a strong support from those organizations.
We've been speaking with the two candidates running for Congress in the 4th Congressional District, Julie Hall and Jake Auchincloss. We have time for one lightning round question before final responses. So Jake and Julie, I'm going to ask you the same question. There'll be 30 seconds each for response. Massachusetts is facing a housing affordability crisis. What is your top priority in addressing it in your district? Julie, 30 seconds.
Well, I think what we need to do is we need to have more affordable housing in the area. We're starting to build some of that. One of the things that I was able to do here in Attleboro, we have what's called a tiered income level housing. We were able to take buildings of opportunity and work with the labor and work with actually the historical society, because a lot of these buildings here in Attleboro are older buildings. We were able to refurbish them. I call them reuse buildings, but I think having mixed tiered opportunities is the best way to go.
Thank you. And Jake, 30 seconds.
An issue near and dear to my heart. I've been on the Land Use Committee in the City Council for 5 years fighting for affordable housing. We need to adopt elements of Elizabeth Warren's housing policy that uses carrots and sticks to liberalize zoning in cities and towns so we can build more housing. We've got to expand funding for Section 8 low-income housing, and we've got to make the federal program that allows low-income renters to earn equity in their homes more robust.
I really appreciate both of you taking time today on a short show. There's just never enough time to cover everything, but I think we've gotten to a lot. I now want to leave time for each of you to have a 1 minute closing statement. As I said at the beginning, we flipped a coin, and Julie Hall will be giving her closing statement first. This is Julie Hall, the Republican candidate in the race. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'm not a professional politician. I'm an ordinary person. I don't come from a wealthy family like my opponent or a famous family, but I do come from a good, solid middle-class family, right from the heart of the district. We are the people that get up every day. We go to work. We take care of our families. We struggle to get ahead. My parents, they both worked. And these are the people that are most negatively impacted by increased taxes. We are the people that have been neglected for so many years, the rest of the district. And I am running to represent them. It's time for them to have a voice, finally. And I don't have to pretend that I'm like them. I am them. And I'm from here, and I want to be the voice. I also want to be a conservative voice. We haven't had a conservative voice in this area for so long. So please, vote for Julie Hall on November 3rd. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Julie Hall. I'll turn now to Jake Auchincloss, the Democratic candidate in this race. Jake, 1 minute for your closing remark.
I appreciate you having me on. And yes, it was a short interview, but I think we heard the most substantive element in it, in that my opponent does not have a single substantive disagreement with Donald Trump. By contrast, I think that this president has been the worst in American history, who has left this country weaker, sicker, poorer, and more divided. And I'm going to work with a Biden administration to help us heal and help us rebuild so that we can confront our longstanding racial injustices, so that we can fight climate change and transition to a clean energy economy, so that we can protect women's access to safe and legal abortions, and of course, so that we can put science in the driver's seat and get to the other side of this COVID pandemic so we can safely reopen our economy and get kids back into the schools.
All right. Well, listen, I want to start by apologizing to both candidates and the listeners for the technical difficulties we had at the beginning. Thank you, both of you, for staying with us through that and participating in what has been an enlightening discussion. It's been a pleasure to moderate this between the two of you. Let me thank you each, Julie Hall, who is running as a Republican for the 4th District. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And Jake Auchincloss, the Democrat in the race. Jake, thank you, too, for joining us.
A pleasure to be on.
And a reminder, listeners, we will have the entire debate on tonight again at 10 p.m. That's when Radio Boston airs again. We'll also have it for you online at our website, radioboston.org. Listen, also, if you want to learn more about what's on the ballot this November, if you have an Amazon device at home, you can try out WBUR's interactive guide to this year's ballots questions. It's a new tool we're using as a companion to our political coverage. All you have to do is ask your device to open Mass Ballot Guide.